Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of whether Donald Trump is already a captive of the Republican establishment he ran against, or will he, as promised, drain the swamp and make America great again? Sam Tenenhaus, a columnist at Prospect Magazine and the former editor of the New York Times Book Review and the Week in Review section, joins us to discuss his latest article at the New York Times, Donald Trump's Art of the New Deal, and whether Trump's statements to the editors of the New York Times indicate he is abandoning his campaign promises of bringing back torture, denying climate change, jailing Hillary Clinton, and deporting 12 million undocumented immigrants. We'll also look into whether, like Eisenhower, Trump will not dismantle democratic programs such as Social Security and rebuild the nation's infrastructure. Then we'll discuss Trump's selection for Secretary of Education with Diane Ravitch, who served as Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush and is the author of Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. She joins us to assess whether the billionaire champion of charter schools and privatized education, Betsy DeVos, will be the nail in the coffin of public schools in America and base the country's future education on the for-profit college model that is essentially a taxpayer-funded racket that makes scam artists rich while leaving students with a lifetime of debt and a worthless education. Then finally, we'll look into whether or not the Clinton campaign will act on the urging from prominent computer scientists and voting rights attorneys to challenge the recent election results in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania before the looming deadlines expire. Investigative journalist Andrew Gumbel, the author of Down for the Count, Dirty Elections, and the Rotten History of Democracy in America, joins us to discuss how, in Wisconsin, Clinton received 7% fewer votes in counties with electronic voting machines compared to counties that used optical scanners and paper ballots, and whether Russian interference could be a factor in the close Electoral College vote. And joining us now is Sam Tenenhaus, a columnist at Prospect Magazine and a contributor to Bloomberg, who previously was the editor of the New York Times Book Review and the Week in Review section of the Times. He was formerly a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, and his book, Whitaker Chambers, a biography, was a finalist for both the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. His latest book is The Death of Conservatism, A Movement and Its Consequences, and he has an article at the New York Times, Donald Trump's Art of the New Deal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Tenenhaus.
Oh, good to be back with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Sam. And it does seem that there's some, I guess, I don't know whether it's a mystery or it'll probably be revealed soon, but it seems as though there are two possible scenarios with this massive tectonic shift that's taken place in our politics with the election of Donald Trump. Is it possible that he is the Republican Party, the establishment and the Koch brothers, et cetera? Is he their useful idiot who's delivered them the trifecta and they don't need him anymore? Or is he somebody that is going to be an assertive president? He's got the mob behind him. If the Republican establishment doesn't play ball with him, he can turn the mob on them. I guess it's rather trite to say we'll wait and see. But what's your take on it?
Well, I think there could be two conflicts that will determine how Trump plans to govern, if he really does. That is to say, whether he has a vision of what he wants to do. One will be the competition, you might call it, between him and Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, is very much a familiar Reagan-style supply-side conservative. Trump is ideologically almost unformed, as far as we know. He has emotions and predispositions, but we don't know that he has an agenda. So there I would look at the partnership, if that's what it turns out to be, between his chief political advisor, Stephen Bannon, and his chief of staff, Reince Priebus. It's the same division between the outsiders who have become populists, really, and allied themselves with what's now being called the Rust Belt Republicanism, and the more doctrinaire Beltway conservative ideologues. And whether there is a fusion of those two or an outright conflict could tell us a lot.
So would Mike Pence then be the bridge between those two?
You know, that's a very good question. He could be. Something for listeners to think about, Ian, is a little history if it doesn't bore people out of their minds, is for a long time before the modern conservative movement began that we associate with people like William F. Buckley Jr. and Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan, conservative and Republican politics were really based in the Midwest, in states like Ohio and Wisconsin, and those are coming back to the fore now. Priebus is from Wisconsin. Paul Ryan is from Wisconsin. Mike Pence is from Indiana. This is the heart of the heart of the country, as they used to call it. And it's really going to be a matter of what is driving politics and policy there. I think that's one reason we all forget Scott Walker, but he was supposed to be the bright hope of that wing of the party. And, of course, Trump just obliterated him as he did everyone else. But it's a kind of an older style Republicanism. It's more isolationist, if we still want to use that term. And it has to do with kind of the values of small town and rural America. And it's so will policies be geared toward them? The big infrastructure plan that I wrote about, or infrastructure vision, it's not a plan yet. Is that something that will be done on terms that much of the country can understand and prosper from? Well, then you could actually have a presidency that does something. You know, it's one of these painful ironies for Democrats and progressives is that sometimes it takes someone on the other side to do the things they've been pushing for a long time.
Well, it does appear to be the possibility of triangulation on the part of the Democrats if indeed Paul Ryan is not interested in the infrastructure plan and is concerned about deficits. I mean, first of all, we do have this peculiar crisis in capitalism itself where you have massive deficits on the one hand and then massive surpluses piled up offshore with corporate surpluses. So if you could bring those two together, you would be, I think, something, you know, Trump can have an amazingly successful presidency if his infrastructure plan worked. But there are some legitimate criticisms of it, the way it appears to be emerging so far, in as much as there'll be a one-time repatriation for all that corporate money offshore with low taxes on that. And then they get another tax break if they reinvest in infrastructure. And then furthermore, if they build roads, there'll be toll roads and they'll get revenues from that. So if the Dems could move in on that, make it more user-friendly and less plutocratic-friendly, then we may have a deal.
It is possible. And also what the Democrats would have to be prepared to do politically, which is very tough, is not get a lot of credit for it. You know, Jonathan Chait, who's a very smart journalist for New York Magazine, is warning the Democrats not to do this. He said, Congress never gets credit for anything big that happens. Credit always accrues to the presidency. So Schumer and company would have to decide it doesn't matter, that they would rather just get this good thing done and hope for something else to create trouble for Trump, which could easily happen. I mean, all these questions about his own investments overseas and his unwillingness to put his holdings in a blind trust and all the rest. We've never seen anything like this before. And at this point, the public is watching or kind of half watching. But that's the kind of issue that could really be a problem. And so Trump will have to decide what to do with that. That'll require a major call by him on what he's going to do with all those holdings.
So notwithstanding the dressing down that Donald Trump gave the network news executives and anchors the other day, he did show up at the New York Times yesterday. And I was amused by his exchange with the columnist Frank Bruni, where he said, you know, you're going to be writing good things about me. So this is a man who wants to be loved, and you know, in spite of the fact that he ran a campaign in large part based on hate. So I guess the question here is the people that the white working class that got him over the top, that in effect the Democrats abandoned, will they be seduced and abandoned, or will they be the people that he is loyal to, since he seems to be loyal to people who support him?
That is the great question. My colleague Jacob Heilbrun, colleague and friend, I think you've interviewed him.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I think fairly recently I was in Washington when he spoke with you. And he says, you know, a year from now, people in Youngstown, Ohio will be throwing tomatoes at Donald Trump. Who knows? it's just impossible to predict. Also, you know, there was a brilliant essay written many years ago in Commentary magazine before it became kind of rigidly neoconservative, sort of a liberal magazine, by Richard Goodwin, who had worked for both John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. And it was about the incoming age of Reagan, which he predicted would happen and did after Reagan was elected governor of California. And Goodwin said, we have this funny relationship with the government, we being all Americans. On the one hand, we denounce it and say we hate it. On the other hand, we expect it to do everything. And so if the economy is wobbly, well, that's the government's fault. What are they going to do to rescue it? And you find the same thing on the right. There's kind of an assumption that if only we put the right person in the White House, everything will get better. So that even when we hear arguments that are anti-government coming from the right, which Trump has never made, by the way, that's one of the interesting facets of his political identity, is that he's not an anti-government type at all. But when you hear those arguments, it still comes from people who think, well, if we got the right person in the White House, everything would get better. The stock market would soar. People would be back to work. We wouldn't be fighting wars we don't like and all the rest. So, but the real point there is many of those things lie outside the compass of the president's influence. Not wars, but the economy, a great deal of it does. So if the economy happens to get better, it was probably, we know it's been on an upturn actually for a number of years. So if does Trump become the beneficiary of that, he could get elected to a second term. Remember, all our last three presidents, all three of them, have served two consecutive terms, which has not happened in our history almost since the founding, where three presidents in a row served out two full terms. You have to go back 200 years to the last time that happened. So is Trump able to extend that, or does this all get exposed as a kind of charlatanry? It's just impossible to say. It's really interesting to watch, though.
Well, as you point out in your New York Times article, Sam Tannenhaus, Donald Trump's Art of the New Deal, he did reach out, as we know, successfully to the white working class. And he also, as you say, it was easy to snicker when he asked African-American audience what they had to lose by supporting him. But if he was indeed sincere, how do you explain Jeff Sessions as the attorney general?
Yeah, that is where the loyalty comes up again, doesn't it? Where Sessions was the first major beltway figure to endorse him. And Trump is rewarding him. And look, Sessions is someone of experience and skill, and I think it's easy to overlook that too. But the record on race and immigration really are troubling. He is now supervising the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, and that was created, you know, as part of the 1957 Civil Rights Act, which no one remembers, created under a Republican president, Dwight Eisenhower. And if he really tries to dismantle that in some way or roll it back, that's just not good for the country. That's bad for everybody. And one would hope there'd be a political price to pay for that. Now, it seems as if he's appointed Nikki Haley to be the United Nations ambassador, and that seems like an interesting and smart choice. There was room for him to do more. As I pointed out in that piece as well, Ian, and I'm not the first to say this by any means, Trump did poorly with various ethnic groups, but he actually did better than Mitt Romney with almost all of them, which shows you that, first of all, Republicans just don't command the loyalty of those voters, but also that what Trump was saying was not as shocking or alienating to them as it might have seemed to white liberals. And I think that's something we should keep in mind. He got 29% of the Latino vote, which is not great, but it's better than Romney did. And after all the things Trump said, you would think he would have gotten half that percentage.
Now, it's extraordinary to think that he got roughly 1 in 3 of the Latino votes. But in terms, though, of the national security portfolios, now, he apparently in his New York Times meeting yesterday, he explained why he's no longer pursuing torture and waterboarding, etc., because of a conversation he had with the General Mad Dog Mattis, who is
right,
going to be his Secretary of Defense, where Mattis said to him, you know, you'll get more from a prisoner or POW, you get more out of them by giving them a beer and a pack of cigarettes than by torturing them. And that apparently that completely changed his complete outlook.
And you know, there's a lesson in that, too. That's the way you reason with Trump. That's what you tell him.
Right. Right.
You tell him something very vivid that comes out of normal experience.
Right.
You would get that. But, not the worst thing.
No, but what about we talked about loyalty in terms of Sessions. And obviously, it also applies to the National Security Advisor, which is an extremely important position. And he's a little bit scary to a lot of people, General Mike Flynn.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And it could be that what he does is to create a cabinet. You make me realize this, Ian, as a possibility. That is, again, split in just the same way, where you have hard-line ideological figures on the one hand, and then kind of practical, pragmatic operators on the other. And, and I think in some interpretations of all of this, people get things wrong. You know, there was this great sigh of relief that Priebus was going to be the chief of staff and not Bannon. But in some ways, Priebus is the more ideological figure than Bannon. Bannon is a controversial and inflammatory figure, but he's not tremendously ideological. He's not a familiar kind of Reagan-style Republican, much though he admires Reagan. He's the one who's pushing for the gigantic infrastructure bill. So those differences, the kind of breakdown in the cabinet, as well as the circle of advisors Trump has around him, could end up being more complicated than we think. The dynamics could be a little different. He could be the sort of president who's most impressed by someone who can make an engaging argument than by someone who marshals ideological principles. And that's not a bad thing.
So not a team of rivals, but a cabinet of rivals?
Well, you know, there's many are questioning that and saying, no, he's doing one hardliner after another. But I think it could be. And more a kind of cabinet of rivals. It's possible. And, of course, that's all Abraham Lincoln did. You know, people have pointed out Lincoln was not the first president to do that, to put people with different points of view, including some who had challenged him in his cabinet. You know, we've seen that before, and we've seen it since. If we don't know where he is with Romney, right? We still haven't heard whether he wants to give Romney a job or just kind of publicly humiliate him. Is that right?
Well, I think it's really, if there was an offer, the ball's in Romney's court, and I think he's probably trying to figure out, could I work for this guy? Could I take orders from this guy?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's what you have to do.
Right.
And he's not above reminding all these people of it. But you know what? There are a lot of other presidents who would have done it too, like Nixon. People really came after Trump. I don't mean liberals and Democrats. I mean within the Republican establishment. They tried to take him down. Cruz and company, you know, really tried to stop him. And just in a human level, it's not so surprising that he should remember those slights. He's also thin-skinned, we know, and he has a long memory for what seemed to him betrayals or really proper shows of deference. Never forget, you know, he lives in a giant gilded triplex in Manhattan, those of you who know New York, but he's really from Queens, and Queens is very different from Manhattan.
Right.
He's got a little bit of that chip on his shoulder.
I was going to say, that seems to be in the DNA of his need to be loved. He's the boy from Queens who's never been accepted by the New York elite, right? Now he's got the top job in the world, right?
Yeah, there's much to that, and he got this job. It's quite amazing. I wish I was still at the Times just to see him come in, although apparently you couldn't. They brought him in through a loading dock and back. And then there's video on the site, but I've heard from friends at the paper that you couldn't get a glimpse of him, really. But it was quite an event. And when I saw the images of him seated next to Arthur Sulzberger, who owns the paper, his family owns the paper, in that conference room, I remember doing video interviews there. I interviewed the great John Updike in that boardroom. And it has photographs of all these historic figures, including, you know, signed portrait from Churchill, from Truman, and Charles Chaplin, and Lindbergh, and there's Trump, President-elect Trump. It's hard to wrap your mind around.
Yeah, and this is what he calls the failing New York Times, yet he came to them. They didn't go to him like everybody else has paid homage at Trump Tower.
And he also helped them a little bit with circulation. But the Times and Trump will be a very interesting dynamic to watch. The paper doesn't have many conservative columnists, and the one they have, Ross Douthat, has been very critical of Trump. So it'll be interesting to see how the paper adjusts itself to this new administration. And I have been asked to mention names, you know, because I write about conservatives and people in that world. You know, I'm kind of a chronicler, so I've been asked, well, what are names of people we should be going to, who can write for us, this kind of thing. All that is good. All that is good. I mean, I think we did see that much of the liberal media, so-called, really was operating inside a bubble during this election. It's not that there wasn't a great deal of good journalism. There was, but it came freighted with presumptions. And those presumptions, I think, limited, and I mean, not just the New York Times, but also through the Washington Post and magazines like the New Yorker. They couldn't always get outside their own set of suppositions. They couldn't quite believe any of this was happening. And so they missed some of the stories, I think. We all did. I did too.
Well, just in closing, the one thing that I think a lot of liberals liked about Trump's campaign was when he went after the Republican foreign policy orthodoxy, particularly of George W. Bush, even though he himself perhaps didn't oppose the Iraq war at the time, but later did. He nevertheless basically spoke truth to the Republican foreign policy establishment, saying this was a catastrophe. It's not exactly difficult to see that it hasn't been a catastrophe. And even though, you know, there's a possibility of a Bolton as a Secretary of State and going after Iran, Iran was clearly the winner of the Iraq war, and the chips have fallen in a very agonizing way where it's the Iraq war still continues to this day. He did meet with Tulsi Gabbard, a serving military officer who was a supporter of Bernie Sanders. What do you make of that? Is there a possibility that there's more than rhetoric to that? I mean, I know he was essentially embarrassing Bush's brother when he said all that stuff early in the campaign. But nevertheless, do you think he gets it?
It's possible he does. You know, for a number of years now, people like Rand Paul, remember him, have been saying, you know, can't we just set the word isolationist on a shelf somewhere and just say what we're really talking about is not having crusading adventures overseas, kind of reckless interventionism. If you look at Trump's politics, his foreign policy is coming out of that old America First, pre-World War II right, the old guard Republican Party, as it was once called. It's quite in keeping with it, and it's a much more kind of national sovereignty, national interest, realism in foreign policy. Even Cruz had some of that. So I don't think it's out of the question that while he can be very aggressive and belligerent sounding, he's actually going to keep, he might keep the country out of more of these conflicts. And I quite agree about the campaign. Some of the most memorable moments, of course, came early in the Republican nomination contest. And one was the South Carolina primary, which people will remember very well because Trump in it managed one of his few start-to-finish complete coherent sentences without interruptions. You know, he's always kind of zigzagging. And in this one, he said something like, I think it's pretty close to accurate, he said, "They lied about the war in Iraq. They told us there were weapons of mass destruction, and there were none." And he said it in South Carolina, with Bush on the stage. South Carolina is one of the most conservative states in the Union we know, with many military personnel. Trump said that, and he won. He won the primary, and Jeb left the race after that, even after he'd brought his brother in. No Democrat could possibly say that. And it was amazing that it didn't hurt Trump. The neoconservatives assumed he was finished after that, and he wasn't.
Well, Sam Tannenhaus, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great talking to you, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Sam Tannenhaus, who's a columnist at Prospect Magazine and a contributor to Bloomberg, who was previously the editor of the New York Times Book Review and the Weekend Review section of the Times. He was formerly a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, and his book, Whitaker Chambers, a biography, was a finalist for both the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. And his latest book is The Death of Conservatism, A Movement and Its Consequences. And he has an article at the New York Times, Donald Trump's Art of the New Deal. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back discussing Trump's election for Secretary of Education. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Diane Ravitch, a professor in New York University Steinhardt School of Education and one of America's best-known education experts. She served as Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush, and through extensive speaking and writing, she established a reputation as a conservative champion of school choice, testing standards, No Child Left Behind, and other programs, claiming to make schools more efficient and effective. In her book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, Ravitch explains how she came to make a radical break with those policies, and her recent book is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Welcome to Background Briefing, Diane Ravitch.
It's great to be with you again.
And I wish it was under better circumstances, because Donald Trump's nomination of Betsy DeVos to become the next education secretary is clearly a huge victory for the conservative school voucher charter school movement in this country. It sort of reminds me of the choice of Jeff Sessions to become the Attorney General, because he will certainly destroy the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. And it would seem to me that Betsy DeVos will destroy the Education Department, or at least change it in an extremely conservative direction.
I think that what Betsy DeVos will do will be to attack public education across America. That's what she's done in Michigan, and she has she's a billionaire. Her family owns the Amway Corporation, and she is very dedicated to vouchers, vouchers for religious schools, for private schools, for homeschools, for anything. She has supported charters, but she believes that charters should be completely unregulated and unsupervised. The Michigan legislature, which is controlled by Republicans, tried to introduce legislation to put some requirements for accountability on charter schools. She spent over $1 million defeating that legislation because she doesn't want any accountability or supervision for charters, and she wants everyone to have a voucher to go wherever they want to go. She is an enemy of public schools.
Well, you'd have to add to this, and given the Michigan connection, that Eli Broud, who comes from Detroit, has pushed for the privatization of education in Detroit, and it's been an absolute catastrophe. I mean, it's not, you don't have to be Einstein to figure out that if you take monies away from public schools and give them to charter schools, you can't expect public schools to, in other words, they're almost fulfilling the canard that the public school system is broken. Well, by taking money away from them, you sure as hell are breaking it.
Well, it actually, the charter schools have been like a parasite on public education, and you described it well. They take money away from public schools, and then public schools lose teachers, lose programs. They can't cut the cost of transportation. They can't cut the cost of running their building. And so there are fixed costs to the public schools, and what has to go are teachers and programs. And that makes, and also larger class sizes are a result. So that becomes, as you say, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy that the public schools then become weaker as the charter schools become stronger. But the public schools, nonetheless, everywhere except in New Orleans, serve the majority of children. So we're destroying the system that serves the great majority of children in order to allow privatization to suck off profits. And by the way, in Michigan, at Bessie DeVos's insistence, 80% of the charter schools operate for profit.
So to be charitable, maybe you can say Eli Broud and Bill Gates and these billionaires meddling in education are well-meaning, but I don't think you can say that for Betsy DeVos. She's an ideologue.
Well, she is certainly an ideologue. I mean, she does believe in choice. She does believe in privatization. And she probably has intentions that are just as good as Bill Gates and Eli Broad, but they're just misinformed. I don't know that they've ever been in a public school. I think that Eli Broad actually attended public schools, but his meddling in Detroit has certainly not made the schools better there. In fact, all the schools there, charter schools as well as voucher, they don't have voucher schools in Michigan, but they do in Wisconsin, right next door. Michigan has a lot of charter schools. Detroit has a lot of charter schools. They are no better than the public schools, and both systems are drowning.
So it seems that Donald Trump's methodology, if there is one, in choosing the cabinet, is to sort of throw a bone in both directions. With Sessions, you've got an arch-conservative in charge of justice, and you've got a very troublesome choice as a national security advisor. You've got the possibility of Dr. Ben Carson now as the next Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. He will ruin that, as will, as I mentioned earlier, Sessions, at least in terms of the Civil Rights Division. So, and then you've got on the other side, you've got Romney, possibly a Secretary of State, unusual choices, and Nikki Haley.
Well, we haven't yet seen the selection for Secretary of State, and that may all be a kind of a feint to throw people off guard. To see any reasonably intelligent and thoughtful person in any cabinet position under Donald Trump would give us reason to breathe a sigh of relief. Thus far, he has not even thrown a bone other than interviewing Romney. And far from uniting the country, he might be trying to unite the Republican Party. But the people who've been announced represent the far right and the ideologues and the extremists and the alt-right. I'm kind of thinking we should just say neo-Nazi and drop the term alt-right.
Well, that's the term that they chose for themselves. I don't know why we oblige them in calling them what they want to be called, as opposed to I think is a more accurate term, neo-Nazi.
Well, those with, let's say, fascistic tendencies and people who use race and religion and other kinds of characteristics as a way of demonizing their opponents, that has the smell of the 1930s about it.
So let's talk then a little bit about what Betsy DeVos has done so far. Betsy DeVos apparently played a role in pushing a 2000 ballot proposal to create a school voucher system in Michigan. She wasn't successful. Her husband also ran, didn't he run against Jennifer Granholm, who became the governor?
Yes, but I don't think there was a voucher proposal on the ballot in Michigan, because what Betsy DeVos and her husband do is they spend a lot of money, millions, to push vouchers. And in the Washington Post description of her, they said that when she began her pro-voucher efforts, there were really no states that had voucher programs, and there are now 29 states that have voucher programs. We've always had in this country, up until the last 15 years or so, a very sharp dividing line between church and state. And public money, actually most state constitutions say public money should go to public schools. And in the state of Washington, the judges there, the Supreme Court of the state of Washington, said charter schools are not public schools, and they refused to allow public money to go to charter schools. But here we will have, if she's confirmed, and I assume she will be, a Secretary of Education who wants public money to go to Christian schools, fundamentalist schools, Catholic schools, Jewish schools, Muslim schools, homeschooling, anything you can think of, because she makes this crazy logical leap that if parents are making a choice, education is better, and that's simply not true. There have been many studies done at voucher schools. We have yet to see any studies that say that they're a great success, and have quite a few studies that say that the kids make no gains at all, and their teachers are usually uncertified, and this is not education reform.
So we've spoken in the past, Diane Ravitch, about the four-college profit racket, and it's been exposed endless examples of these big companies like Corinthian going bankrupt and leaving all of these students, mostly vets and aspirants to the middle class, who get conned into signing up, getting student loans, and the taxpayer ends up spending over 90 cents per dollar to fund this for-profit college racket that spends an awful lot of its money on self-promotion and leaves these kids high and dry with massive student debt and a worthless diploma, if indeed they get a diploma. And that is the model, and I'm not exaggerating when I call it a racket. And isn't that same model that we already have, this disgrace known as the for-profit college industry, is that just simply going to be expanded now into...
Absolutely. And in fact, after Trump was elected, the stocks of the for-profit college industry soared. I mean, the market went up, but the for-profit college companies, their stocks went up even faster. And the same thing is true in the area of privatized prisons. The Obama administration Justice Department did a study last summer and reached the conclusion that the privatized prisons were not saving money and that the quality was terrible. And they had a riot where a guard was killed. And so they decided, and they announced that the federal private prisons would be put out of business, and they would go back to having prisons run by the Bureau of Prisons. That's going to be reversed, and the two big companies that provide private prisons, they saw their stock go up. So we will see the privatization of everything that government is now doing to the extent that Trump is able to promote it. This is going to be a period of graft and corruption and fraud unlike anything we've seen since possibly the 1920s when we had the Teapot Dome scandal.
But essentially, Betsy DeVos will extend the for-profit college model into the rest of education, right, K through 12 and high school.
Well, I should think so, because in her own state of Michigan, as I said, 80% of the charter schools operate for profit, and they're not very good schools, but they do operate for profit.
And the oversight is pretty negligible, isn't it?
The Michigan schools are not good schools. The charter schools are bad schools. But the state doesn't have any accountability for the charter schools. And that's the way the DeVos family wants it. So I think that Michigan should be looked at as a paradigm for what she wants for the nation.
Well, just in closing, Diane Ravitch, since this election in many ways could be explained where the less educated voted in Donald Trump and the more educated actually voted in the majority president, who was Hillary Clinton. She's now passed the 2 million vote in having more votes in the popular vote than Donald Trump, and probably by the end of the counting will be 2.5 million ahead in the popular vote. That has been the dichotomy a lot of people have seen. You know, we know on the stump Donald Trump said, "I love the poorly educated." It would seem to me that you could make the conclusion, without appearing to be too cynical, that this is a win for the plutocracy. If the plutocracy in this country wants stupid people that will vote for them and their interests and vote against their own interests, that would seem to be the direction that we're heading in.
Yes, I agree, because my view of the election is, first of all, I have a lot of trouble accepting that every pollster in the country was wrong. We know that the Russians were hacking the Democratic National Committee and wherever else they wanted to hack. And I predicted before the election that we would have no way of knowing whether the Russians were hacking into voting machines because of the switch from paper ballots to electronic machines. And it's not that complicated. If you can hack anything you want, why not hack the vote? So I don't feel very comfortable about saying the words President Trump, but to the extent that working people voted for President Trump, they were hoaxed. The Republican Party is the same old Republican Party that's always taken care of the 1%. Trump's tax plan will benefit the 1%, people just like himself. Maybe it'll benefit most the 0.1%. He's not going to bring jobs back. He's going to drop every promise he made. He's not going to build a wall. He's not going to close the doors to every Muslim. He's not going to deport 11 million undocumented people. I mean, everything he said was just for show. It was like, say anything to get elected. And I think that there are some very serious consequences, one of which is that public education, which is a bedrock of any democratic society, is at risk. And we might well see by at the end of 4 years public money flowing to totally unaccountable for-profit charter chains and religious schools that have no accountability whatsoever for public money.
Well, Diane Ravitch, in a moment we'll be turning to the issue of the extent to which there were irregularities in this election and the possibility of Russian involvement. And I thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Diane Ravitch. She's a professor at New York University Steinhardt School of Education and one of America's best-known education experts. She was Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush, and through extensive speaking and writing, she established a reputation as a conservative champion of school choice testing standards, No Child Left Behind, and other programs claiming to make schools more efficient and effective. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether or not the Clinton campaign will act on the urging from prominent computer scientists and voting rights attorneys to challenge the recent election results. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Andrew Gumbel, who has worked as an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and The Atlantic. He's the author of several books, including Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed, and Why It Still Matters. And his latest book is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Gumbel.
Thank you so much.
And there are efforts underway to get the Hillary Clinton campaign to call for an investigation into the voting counts in and the voting systems in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. And the people that are leading this effort are John Boniface and Alex Haldeman, who's the director of the University of Michigan Center for Computer Security and Society. So this is not sort of the professional sky is falling black box Cassandras that have kind of muddied the waters in many ways in this extremely important issue about the broken voting systems here in the United States. You also have, of course, the specter of Russian involvement. So where do we stand now? I believe that the Clinton people only have a couple of days to make the decision. I believe the deadline in Wisconsin is on Friday, and I think in Pennsylvania is on Monday. So what do you think is going to happen?
Well, in terms of prognostication, it's unlikely, I think, that we're going to see any kind of audit or recount in any of those states. And I think that's a great shame for a number of reasons which have been articulated by all the people you mentioned. And, you know, anybody who cares about the integrity of the vote in this country, one thing that has been a standard request by the voting rights community for a number of years is to have routine sample manual audits of the vote where possible, where the machinery allows it, just to be sure that the results haven't been thrown off by a machine malfunction or any kind of mischief along the lines that, you know, we may or may not have seen being perpetrated by the Russians or people sympathetic to the Trump campaign. So, you know, this is something that's been a longstanding request that has been ignored. Now, in order for the Clinton campaign to make a case that something should be done, the ordinary way this happens is if the race is close enough to trigger a formal recount. And that is not necessarily the case. Certainly in Pennsylvania, I think the Clinton is a little under one percentage point behind, but not enough to trigger a recount under the ordinary circumstances. It's much closer in Wisconsin and Michigan. You know, we still don't have an official result, but it appears that she is, you know, behind by just a very few tens of thousands of votes there as well. So ordinarily, that's what they do. And I think the Clinton campaign finds itself in a bind, because if they ask for any kind of audit or recount, they're going to be accused of trying to, you know, claw back from what everybody has by now concluded, where, you know, the majority of the country has concluded was a defeat. So in political terms, it's a risky thing to do. And, you know, frankly, if such an audit were to occur, you know, I think most people, including the computer scientists who've asked for it, you know, they're reasonably sure that the result is correct. Now, is reasonably sure enough with an election of this, you know, importance and this closeness? You know, I would argue, no, it's not. We should be absolutely sure of the result. And there is a way of doing it. You can take with the paper ballots, you know, the optically scanned ballots, like the ones we have in Los Angeles County, you can do a random recount of, you know, a certain percentage point of the ballots, depending on the closeness of the race in any given precinct. And you can quickly establish, you know, is this right or is this not right? And if it's not right, you count more. And if necessary, you recount everything. And it's, you know, it's a practice that exists in other countries. It's a practice being pushed in this country, you know, in vain for a very long time. So, you know, the short answer is it should happen, but most likely it won't. And, you know, we'll see what the Clinton people do. You know, but they have a political calculation to make as well as one that reflects on the integrity of the voting system.
But nobody questions the credentials of Alex Haldeman of the University of Michigan Center for Computer Security and Society. And his apparently investigation shows that in Wisconsin, Clinton received 7% fewer votes in counties that relied on electronic voting machines compared with counties that used optical scanners and paper ballots. So my understanding is that 2/3 of Pennsylvania relied also on the electronic voting machines. So, you know, that makes you think.
You're absolutely right. And in Pennsylvania, we knew going in that this is a vulnerability of the system. And unfortunately, you know, unfortunately, if you happen to be a partisan of Hillary Clinton, most of the electronic voting machines in Pennsylvania are in Philadelphia and in Pittsburgh, the two biggest urban centers, which are also the two richest sources of Democratic votes. So, you know, if you were, let's say, for the sake of argument, the Russian government, and you wanted to throw the election to Trump, you know, that is where you would probably try hardest to intervene. So, you know, that is, you know, in and of itself, a cause of concern. In terms of, you know, the spread of where the turnout was and where it wasn't, you know, there are ways of cross-checking that with exit polls, with looking at demographic groups, how they voted and how they behaved generally, you know, within the state and across the country. And, you know, there's no indication of a major anomaly based on that data. But, you know, is a minor anomaly that was created through, you know, subterfuge and cheating possible? Absolutely. And, you know, when Nate Silver says that he doesn't see much scope for, you know, cheating along these lines to have taken place, you know, let's not forget that he's somebody who talks about, you know, percentages of probability of things happening. And, you know, I don't know what percentage he would ascribe to this, but let's say it's, you know, 80% sure that the result is correct. That still means there's a 20% chance it's wrong. And, you know, again, I think the interests of good government and the integrity of elections is that we should investigate this. And on top of that, you know, the fact that we know, according to the country's intelligence agencies, that the Russians have attempted to insert themselves into the electoral process. We also know through the leak of John Podesta's email and other things, and the hacks and the attempted hacks into DNC and election offices around the country, we know that there's been an intention to play dirty. And, you know, under the rules of American elections, nothing can be done about the things that happened before the election. But I do think it would be prudent to make sure that nothing happened during the electoral process itself. So, you know, I'm absolutely with Alex Haldeman. The other thing he points out, which I think is worth repeating to our listeners, is, you know, he talks about how you would practically go about doing a hack. And, you know, it's important for everybody to remember that every county in most states has a different system, you know, that it would be a tremendously elaborate process to stage, you know, a comprehensive hack of an election in order to change the outcome. But one thing he talked about, which I think is worth mentioning, is that although you do not have any machines necessarily connected to the internet on election day, they do generally generate a, you know, a ballot image on one computer, which is then copied and put on all the voting machines that are used in the election. That originating computer could potentially be hacked, could be messed with, and you could load it with malware that would then piggyback onto every other voting terminal in that jurisdiction. And, you know, Haldeman says he and his PhD students, if they were criminals, are pretty confident they could do that. So, you know, in other words, there is a feasible path to have done this. And I think, once again, you know, it would be prudent to make sure that this hasn't happened. And if it has happened, to discover it and unroot it.
But Andrew Gumbly, though, you said that what's holding the Clinton campaign back is the idea they don't want to be perceived as having sour grapes and open an election that everybody's accepted that she lost. Well, I'm not sure that everybody has accepted that she lost, because by any measure that the rest of the world's democracies operate under, she won by 2 million votes, and by the end of the counting, she may even win by 3 million votes.
That's absolutely right. And I think, you know, it's worth remembering the difference in style here between Democrats and Republicans. The Republicans tend to be much more ruthless in pursuit of marginal victories in elections. You know, everybody remembers 2000 in Florida, but this year in North Carolina, we have a governor's race where the sitting governor, Pat McCrory, finds himself about 6,000 votes behind his Democratic challenger. And the Republicans in North Carolina, not to put too fine a point on it, are going absolutely nuts. They're alleging that dead people are voting, that people are fraudulently voting. And most of these allegations have been shown up as nonsense by Republican election officials in the various jurisdictions. They're also threatening to throw the whole election into the state legislature, where the Republicans have a comfortable majority, under an obscure state law that says that, you know, if the outcome isn't clear, the state legislature is allowed to take things, matters into their own hands. In other words, what they're really trying to do is to subvert what the numbers are saying. Democrats, for the most part, are very nervous about doing things like that, rightly or wrongly. And I'm sure listeners will have, you know, strongly conflicting views on that, that the Democrats should play harder, should play dirtier, because otherwise they're just going to keep losing these close races with tremendous, you know, negative effects for the agenda that they believe in. But, you know, I do think Clinton is in a tricky situation. What has historically happened, and this is true of both parties at the presidential level, is that both parties have been very reluctant to challenge the outcome of presidential elections unless there is a clear and convincing case that the outcome is genuinely in doubt based on the data we have, rather than going on a fishing expedition for data we do not have. Nixon in 1960 had an opportunity to challenge the results in Chicago. Also, the results in Texas, other places, he chose not to. John Kerry in 2004, you know, had an opportunity to question what had gone on in Ohio. He chose not to. And in both cases, it was because the margin of their opponent's victory in those states was dauntingly large, and the chances of finding enough votes that could overturn the result was, you know, genuinely in doubt. What we have with Clinton is some states, particularly Wisconsin, where it probably is close enough that they would be inclined to request some kind of audit or recount. But other states like Pennsylvania, where the result, where the margin is still pretty small, but it's bigger and more daunting. And I think if they found themselves in a situation where they requested such a thing, it would trigger an enormous political fight. They may not get what they want, and it ends up just dragging the name of the Democrats and everything that they believe in down further at a time when they desperately need to think about recovering and looking forward to the next battle. So, you know, in political terms, there's a lot to lose as well as a lot potentially to gain. You know, we're looking at a Hail Mary situation. Let's say there was an audit or a recount in Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin. They would have to come out ahead in all three states for Hillary Clinton to prevail in the Electoral College vote. There would then be an almighty fight as to the validity of that recount. You know, we'd be looking at, you know, chaos in American politics for months to come. And she has to just make a decision, and her team has to make a decision. Is that kind of risk worth it for what they stand to gain as a result? And, you know, historically, the indications are that they will not do that.
Well, it's bad enough having two misfires in the Electoral College in 15 years, 2000 and the current misfire, where Hillary Clinton got more popular votes and still lost the elections, as was the case in Florida 2000. And if Kerry had intervened in 2004 in Ohio, he would have faced a presidency in which George W. Bush had about 2 million more popular votes, the very situation that we're facing today. Conversely, and of course, the Republicans aren't uncomfortable about that. They're perfectly happy. Democrats probably could not have run the country. There is a crazy double standard.
That's right. And I think, you know, there are a number of structural advantages that the Republicans have either built for themselves or have taken advantage of to make sure that, you know, the playing field really isn't as level as it should be. And, you know, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama vigorously rejected the notion that the system is rigged during the campaign. But really it is, and it's rigged against the Democrats, you know, in a number of ways. You know, we have not only the Electoral College maths that twice, as you say, in the last 16 years has favored the Republicans, even though they lost the popular vote. And, you know, the margin of Hillary Clinton's popular vote victory, as it now looks, is huge. You know, if you think that John F. Kennedy beat Richard Nixon by, I think, something like 120,000 votes in 1960, I think the margin between Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford in 1976 is also, you know, significantly smaller than the margin by which Hillary Clinton is currently ahead in the popular vote. So this is, you know, it is a very jarring fact, and I don't want to underestimate that by any stretch. But, you know, we do live in a system where the Electoral College rules. I think if, you know, John Kerry had won the election but lost the popular vote in 2004, we would no longer have an Electoral College. I think if both parties had seen that they risk being disadvantaged in outrageous ways, it might have actually created the political momentum to do something. I suspect, however, the way that the country is configured and the fact that smaller states tend to punch above their weight in the Electoral College and also tend to lean Republican, that the Republicans are going to be extremely reluctant, if not absolutely opposed, to any kind of reform of the Electoral College, which, you know, let's remember, it's in Article 2 of the Constitution. It would require a constitutional amendment. It would take a great deal of effort to overturn. And as I'm sure we have probably discussed in the past, and your listeners may be aware, there is a workaround that has been proposed called the National Popular Vote Plan, whereby states have formed an interstate compact so that if enough of them can agree to this, they agree that instead of abiding by the vote in their own individual states on election day for presidential elections, they would abide by the national popular vote and give their electoral votes to that candidate.
Sure.
We're a little short of a full majority, but, you know, let's see in years to come if more states don't join and they can reach a point where they control more than half the Electoral College, and then we won't have this problem anymore. But, you know, for the moment, it is a glaring problem. The Electoral College was a relic, really, you know, more than 100 years ago. As soon as the age of mass participation in elections came about, the Electoral College was already a relic because it was created as a kind of safety valve by the founding fathers because they were afraid of too much democracy. We don't live in that world anymore, and the Electoral College is, you know, it's an outrage, really.
Well, I'm sorry we ran out of time, Andrew Gumbel, but I thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Gumbel, who has worked as an award-winning investigative reporter, political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, The Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and The Atlantic. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. Scroll down the right-hand side, sign up for iTunes Podcast, and I'll be back again tomorrow on Thanksgiving Day with a special Thanksgiving program. Bye for now.